This is episode 458 of the Autoblog Podcast. I'm joined this week by David Gluckman and Stephen Ewing, and we talk about this year's North American Car and Truck of the Year finalists, and Alex Nunez drops by with Michelin for a surprise visit as well. That's all ahead on episode 458 of the Autoblog Podcast. Welcome to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Dan Roth. I'm joined this week by David Gluckman.
Hello.
And Stephen Ewing.
Hello.
Stephen has not been on the podcast for a long time. They take you out of the box and let you stop traveling internationally for a little while?
A little bit.
Excellent.
I got to see some places, though.
Some places?
That was cool.
Like the inside of Marriott hotels in various locations?
No, but I did. I will be writing a very nice piece about the similarities and differences of lavatories on Lufthansa versus Delta flights.
Okay. I look forward to it.
You're going to love it.
It's bathroom Damn. Reading.
Excellent. let's just do the garage because I got nothing. I got nothing else. So let's start with you, Stephen. What are you driving this week?
I spent last weekend in the 2016 Audi S3, which is the A3 with the 2-liter turbo, but the super boosty turbo. So it's basically a Golf R that's more expensive, less functional, and more expensive, and more expensive.
I'm sensing a theme.
So it's the 292 horsepower Golf R engine, which is great, but you can't get a manual in the S3.
Which is not great.
Which is not great. And it's the A3 sedan, which I will say, I like the size of that car a lot. It reminds me of old S4s, and I miss little compact sedans that are fast. It sort of reminds me how big things have gotten lately. And when you're like cruising down the freeway, it feels nice. It feels like the right size for the road, and I'm sure on like a nice, you know, the sort of canyon road we always talk about, the car would feel really good there. But it's 48 grand as tested, and whoo, I'm holding the keys for our $27,000 GTI tonight, and I'd way rather have that.
And there's the podcast's first mention of GTI.
The S3 doesn't feel special like the GTI does. The S3, I mean, it doesn't sound particularly good.
How can it not feel special?
Good,
it's like twice the price.
Well, yeah, it is almost twice the price. But it, you know, you put the thing into dynamic engine sound mode and you can kind of hear it, maybe.
Wait. Dynamic engine sound mode.
Oh, it's not actually called. You go into the Audi Drive Select and there's the, you can change the steering and the engine and then the sound, and you can turn it to dynamic, which I did, and it sounded worse than our GTI, which doesn't have that, by the way.
You know,
well, it
because
has that,
that's
but you can't
stupid.
Turn it on and off.
But you can't turn it on and off.
It has the Soundactor, which is my favorite German word. One of my favorite German words.
Is the Soundactor like one of those Symposer things where it's like a membrane that vibrates sympathetically?
The
or
Soundactor
is like fake
is,
sound over the stereo?
It's a little speaker in the engine bay, or it's actually sort of in the cowl of the, at least on the GTI, I assume it's in the same place in the A3 because it's the same basic architecture underneath. But yeah, it's like a little tiny speaker that makes noise from a place where you would normally get engine noise. So it actually sounds very believable, and they've programmed them really well in the GTI and the A3 and then God knows what else they put them in. But yeah, like Steve said, you can because the car has Drive Select, you can change whether or not it's in its most active or loud mode, and it's just not as pleasant of a. It's an Audi sound. It sounds more like an Audi or like a Turbo 5 or something like that. Instead of
sure.
the 4-cylinder GTI, it sounds like a really good sounding Turbo 4, which yeah. it is.
I can't believe we're talking about high performing sedans.
This car just doesn't really do much for me.
Yeah, but I mean, it's
neither.
A car with a speaker for fake engine noise. What the hell? So what's it like to drive though?
Like a Golf.
And what's it's you know,
it's like a fat, fast all-wheel drive Golf.
It's just like it's softer than the Golf. It's not quite as like it's it's just like an Audi tuned Golf, and I'd prefer the Volkswagen tuned Golf.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I can move a set of snow tires in the back of the GTI. I can't do that in the A3.
Yeah, ever since they stopped making the A3 hatch, so.
Right. Which, I mean, they are going to be selling the A3 hatch here just only as the e-tron, so.
Will that have a sound actor?
Probably.
But will it have a sound?
Right. What's going to come out of that one?
Jetson's noises, I hope.
That would be awesome. That little, like, sound from George.
I don't think that's a Jetson's noise. It's a whirring sound. It's kind of hard to imitate exactly.
But I can't do it on the podcast. But
they probably can't do that because that's a copyrighted sound effect.
No, but if you give me, like, three beers and tell me to make the noise, I'll do it, and it'll sound really great.
Okay, next time. Next podcast.
Okay.
That's a whole lot of money for what it sounds like is not a whole lot of car that's not really all that great to drive. So
yes, it's fine. It's fine. It's a totally decent, lovely car that I was very happy to have for a weekend because it's still comfortable, it's quiet, and it'll move. You know, it's not bad to drive by any means. It's just for the money, I don't really see the point over something like, you know, the Golf R or the GTI. I mean, I did just drive an S4 recently, which that car, you're like, oh, all right, this is cool. And it had a manual, which made it
Yeah, but it also doesn't compete with the Volkswagen line of vehicles. It's right. Going after Mercedes and BMW.
Right. This just doesn't feel as special, I guess, as, you know, the Volkswagens do. A GTI genuinely feels more interesting and special to me than the S3 does.
I think you're bringing a little bit of bias to the plate.
Dan, I've never brought bias to this podcast once in my life.
All right. Well, let's get more unbiased opinion on the podcast. David, what are you driving?
The other night I drove the Lexus GX 460.
I love the Lexus GX. I'm completely biased.
I mean, you're not biased. You just have an incorrect opinion.
No, it's great. It's the best 4Runner ever.
It is the best 4Runner ever, but I don't particularly like the 4Runner to begin with. So, like, the nice thing about the GX is that it doesn't have quite as much brake dive and, like, acceleration squat because it has, an air suspension or something that, like, can control its huge body motion a little bit better.
And it's quieter, and it has the V8, and it's got semi-aniline leather, and it's
It has
nice.
All those things. It has an ancient everything inside. Yeah. It's ancient, I think. It's got the weirdest steering column that, like, doesn't really... It's power adjustable to, like, several settings that aren't useful. It's just, like, it's an old trucky thing, and if you want an old trucky thing with a V8, it's fine. There are many other three-row SUVs that, you know, luxury SUVs that I would look at first, but weird thing about it for me was I got in it and I was like, wait, this car has like a naturally aspirated V8? What? I don't remember the last time I got in a car with a naturally aspirated V8 or like any vehicle with a naturally aspirated V8 for that matter. So,
yeah, and it's that V8.
I mean, compared to the GTI, it's not as practical. It's too expensive.
It's more practical than the GTI.
No.
Yeah.
It's not a Volkswagen.
That V8 is
I didn't hate it. I didn't love it.
Yeah, it's, what is it, 300 and something horsepower out of that V8?
Like two?
The V6 almost gets it.
Yeah, it's not a lot of horsepower, but it's really quiet. Mm-hmm. It's really comfy inside. It's got a suspension that you can adjust from sport to nothing to comfort, and I think that the sport setting is hilarious because I don't know what sport exactly it's designed to play, but
curling.
It's curling. Okay. That's if you don't put the right tires on in the winter, I think. You're just going to
Right. Well, it depends. Like, you're that one
place.
That, like, you're either the one that goes real far or you're the one that's designed to bump into all of the other ones. It depends on
right.
the tires.
Safely bump into them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, there's not... I'll ask the same question, I guess. Like, what is it like to drive?
It did a good job... passing other cars on the highway because it had a V8 engine and torque. It was comfortable. It didn't have any like of the modern safety tech or anything like that, except for like blind spot monitors, I think. So I wasn't able to just like set it to follow traffic and take me home, which was kind of upsetting.
Wait, you know, when you get in a Lexus,
you want to just like tune out from the world, and you don't hear anything, which is nice, but you still see stuff outside. They got to work on that. Maybe some sort of an augmented reality headset that you could wear would be nice, so that you think you're driving a GTI, and then I don't know.
They could put the sound in.
They could. Well, you could just buy a sound actor from a GTI and put it, you know, in your VR helmet.
Right.
We should work on this. We could solve all of everyone's driving problems.
But I thought you liked to drive. Like, even...
I do like to drive. Right. I'm being kidding, as they say. No, it's... What is it like to drive? It's fine. It's, like I said, the suspension is, like, divey and squatty, but not quite as divey and squatty as the 4Runner, which, like, holds the world record in, like, suspension travel at one end of a vehicle. And it's a vehicle. It's large. So
this is what we've gotten from
it. It's funny looking.
Right.
I will point out, ours is, like, the worst color.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a shade lighter than Lexus beige.
It's Jewish racing gold, as Jason Camisa likes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I felt right at home.
Huh.
It was the second night of Hanukkah that I drove it to, so it was like very appropriate for me.
That's perfect. I mean, mm-hmm. I honestly do kind of wonder who actually buys the GX. I like it because of its absurdity. But on the other hand, like, if you're looking for three rows with sort of all-wheel drive and Lexus luxury, there is no other choice. And it strikes me as odd as that's what Lexus has versus a version of the Highlander.
Well, you can get an LX with, like, sort of three rows.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right.
But that's like, that's
no, it is a little strange.
Up.
And I think, wasn't there a rumor that Lexus decided not to do a three row RX, and they basically admitted that, like, that was a huge mistake.
Yeah.
They did the RC coupes instead. They put their money behind, like, a dying segment instead of, I mean, you know, that's foresight and you have to plan like 6 years ahead with that stuff. But they readily admit that they should have the car that you've just described, and they don't have it right now.
Right.
Well,
they should have done a Lexus Venza.
Oh my gosh.
A Venza? Right?
That's basically an RX, though.
Yeah,
just
but
not as funny looking.
Yeah.
They could make the RX.
I mean, I honestly think that, like, a Lexus version of the Venza would have hit their target buyer squarely. That would have been really perfect for that brand. So, when it's our turn to run Lexus, we'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm. When it's my turn to run Lexus, I'm going to work for Autoblog instead. So...
You're already there, then.
Yeah, so I will be
you
here.
You got a head start.
Right.
I will be here until I die.
Okay. Well, it's good to have plans. So...
What are you driving, Dan?
I was just going to get to that. They dropped off a Mitsubishi Mirage this week.
Oh.
Is it the new one with the better face?
No, it still looks kind of marshmallowy, and it's got 11,000 miles on it. So no, it's silver.
Green?
Starlight
green
silver.
A fun color.
No. Although it turns out to be like a surprisingly fun experience. Not that it's fun to drive. Don't
Stop.
Get me wrong. Like,
Stop
it's,
right now.
So, okay. Listen. It's easy to disparage this car. Like,
it's the worst car I've ever tested.
Sure. And like, this one stickers
on
for $17,105
current
with destination.
Cars, maybe.
Yes, and it's the worst car currently on sale that I've ever tested.
And so, again, I took a look at the sticker.
This is like an okay car.
I mean, I just kind of expected this to be like a $9,000 or $10,000 car. It stickers for $17,000. And I'm just like, who does this to themselves for $17,000, especially when there's stuff like the Yaris and the Fit that are right in there in terms of price, or the Versa,
or,
which is a terrible
or any
car.
Any used car.
But it has like auto climate control and stuff.
It does.
And like keyless something.
It does. It has keyless entry and starting.
Engine,
and it has the engine start button on the left side of the steering wheel, like a Porsche.
It's a 911.
Yeah, well, it's a Le Mans start,
right.
For sure. It's
right.
For, you
it
know,
also, the
efficient
entire,
and fast.
The entire car shakes at idle.
Well, because it has three cylinders.
That's how you know it's idling. That's
but you know what?
Feature.
Okay, look, it's easy to sneer at this car, but this is what mobility looks like to the rest of the world. So,
does it have those awesome, like, the least supportive seats in the world?
Yeah, the seats
that have
are, like,
almost like black plastic covers over them with these little tiny purple polka dots in it.
Well, it's got some cloth-ish
seats, but they are the most basic seats. It's very much like, this is what I imagine an enclosed golf cart is like. But to be fair though, like, our vehicles here in the US in this first world market are phenomenally more advanced. This is a basic car, but in some place like, you know, a market like India or China, where cars like this are much more popular and affordable, like, this is not a bad car. It's just, I think it's in the wrong place in that sense. I'm trying to understand it, and I feel like, you know, it does everything just fine. It goes down the road. It even goes on the highway. It didn't really complain. It's a little loud. It's a very mechanical experience. You hear and feel everything, and I, God forbid if I get hit in it, but... I mean, you know, it makes you, so I was like, oh, this thing. And then I felt like a complete jerk. Because I was like, well, you know, honestly, like, this could be the most awesomest car ever for somebody in a different place who doesn't have the privilege that I have. I'm very humble today. So, yes, it is all of the sort of things that make us laugh, but that's not that it's bad. It's just that our desires and tastes, I think, are more sophisticated.
Yes.
How's that?
It's still an awful car.
Very diplomatic.
It's not a car I would choose. Honestly, in this price segment, like, I think the one thing it really has going for it is its MSRP is 15K, and you can probably beat up a Mitsubishi dealer to take a lot of that money off the price. Where if you're buying like a Yaris, they're not going to deal.
Don't beat up a Mitsubishi dealer. That's not nice.
Yeah, you could start by asking nicely, Dan.
Yeah, just
no.
Like,
that is the most adversarial thing that happens. Is you go in and you're going to negotiate with a professional negotiator who spends his day getting better at professionally negotiating. No, I'm going to go in there for blood.
I mean, you can, but
never sell a car to Dan.
No.
Yeah, Dan doesn't have any money to buy cars anyway. I'm giving away the Volvo. I'm going to make a story about it. They're going to come and get it, and they're going to fix it, and they're going to give it to a family who needs a car.
That's nice.
Yeah.
So, stay tuned.
The holiday spirit is taking a hold.
Yes, the force is strong with this one. All right, so here on the Autoblog podcast, we've had some friends stop by. Darth Nunez, who's joined the dark side, and Oscar Pareda from Michelin, who is here to talk about tires, high performance tires, and there's something that's coming up in Detroit that we can't really talk about yet, so we're going to squeeze them and see how much we can actually talk about it. So welcome to the podcast, guys.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks. So,
I'm here too.
And Mike Austin. I was just talking about the special guests. Always good to forget the boss. That's great. First of all, I think tires are one of the things that we talk about a lot on the podcast, mostly in the sense of winter tires, because of, you know, where half the country lives, really. Winter tires are one of those things that we advocate for just because they're a high performance tire of a different type. You can actually stop and turn in slippery conditions. So we're sort of big advocates of that. So you're in good company, Oscar.
Oh yeah, we have
Dan loves tires.
We put winter tires on all of our long term cars. I put winter tires on my personal cars. I haven't done it yet this winter because it hasn't snowed really. But.
Right. Meanwhile, Dan is on some street corner in Massachusetts wearing a sandwich board saying, "Put on winter tires."
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I do. I have a special mini size sandwich board, just for my height. I haven't actually gotten winter tires yet either. I need to get them, but it's right now it's like 60 degrees here in Massachusetts and the heat is on in our building and I'm boiling. So it's, I haven't needed to yet. I'm expecting to get caught in the next blizzard without winter tires and then just go buy them.
Now, I used to live in Detroit myself and actually a few blocks basically from the office here, on Woodward. And I did spend a winter with summer tires, but I was lucky enough to have an A4 with all-wheel drive. So I was playing rally driver. I mean, if it wasn't for all-wheel drive, I would have never gotten anywhere. But even with all-wheel drive, I was slipping all over the place.
Didn't you tell your wife? What you told me that.
Well,
story
I mean,
yesterday.
It was. I had a company car, so she got stuck with the car, and I just told her, "Honey, if you happen to start sliding in a direction you don't want to go in, just point it in the direction you want to go and stay on the gas." So one day she came home and said, it worked. I said, what worked? The car started to go out of control, and I aimed it where I wanted to go and stayed on the gas, and it eventually got it.
All-wheel drive got it.
Yeah. It's not what I advocate, though. I mean, that's definitely, that was before I was working for Michelin.
Right? I was going to say, this sounds like Autoblog podcast heresy, because Dan would be, railing against all-wheel drive and as an alternative to winter tires.
And it's not. It's not.
All-wheel drive plus winter tires.
That's fun. That's fun.
I had a real comeuppance when on the podcast I spent years saying, you don't need all-wheel drive, you don't need four-wheel drive, you don't need SUVs, and then I went out and bought a Grand Cherokee. People pointed that out. And it was just because I really liked the way it drove. And it wasn't for me. It's my wife's car, and that's what she likes, so that's what we got. But Oscar, you're more of the actual high performance tire guy. So Pilot Sport Cups and stuff. Is that you?
The Pilot family is really where I spent most of my time working. So yeah, so it's I like to say the particularly extra fun tires, but they're the high performance sport tires. The Pilot family of tires.
Yeah, when Oscar started at Michelin, he was working on tires for Viper.
Yeah, that's when when I was living here in Detroit, I was working on Viper tire development.
So what makes the Pilot so good? Because that's my favorite tire out of every tire.
Oh wow, man, that's pretty cool. I'm liking this interview.
I know
I'm not in a hot seat. I'm
hostile.
Not a hostile interview.
What's the secret sauce that goes into the Pilot? Because there are other high performance tires. So what sort of makes it stand?
Well, there are a whole bunch of tires. I'd say there isn't any one ingredient, and I think that's also true about the Michelin brand in general. I mean, our approach to making tires isn't about a singular widget that we can point to, and it's because of this widget in the tire that it's better. You might have even heard a phrase that we've been using sometimes called total performance. And what that has to do with is this seriously conscientious approach to making a tire in which we don't just focus on one performance in order to have a marketing slogan or a marketing pitch. Is that, I mean, I started with the company as an engineer, and I can tell you, we really suffer the details. We really do our best to try and enlarge the overall performance envelope. And then you couple that fundamental approach, that it's not just about one performance, it's try to figure out how to balance everything out and grow the overall performance. You match that with two other things. One is an obsessive drive to create new compromise busters. I mean, the latest tire that we are going to be launching next year that I can't talk too much about, I can tell you that when it came time to do the engineering brief of what the challenge is going to be, is literally we went in there and said, okay, look, we have the industry best tire on dry and wet performance, and we want X percent improvement in winter performance, and you can't give up anything else. And that's a really brutal thing to ask an engineer to do, because it's always we got to give somewhere. So it's always that push to try to figure out ways, how can we break the compromises? How can we create new technology that allows us to do things simultaneously that usually means giving up on something? How do we simultaneously improve wet and dry? And that's what actually we were here before this interview, is we were talking about some tire technology and things like figuring out how to use silica to simultaneously improve wet and dry. And then on some of our all-season tires is how do we invent new kinds of elastomers that go into tread compounds that allow a tire to simultaneously work at very high temperatures that you normally have for a UHP tire, but also are very flexible in low winter temperatures. So it's a massive challenge to come up with those compromise busters. And then the third and final thing I would say is we also owe it to the partnerships that we have. It's by working really closely with our partners in motorsports and working with our partners at OE that really push us to come up with these compromise busters.
What's one big tire misconception?
Ooh.
that you fight?
Well, I'll throw this one. This is like a real bonehead one, but this is one of the simplest ones. And we're big on safety, so I'll lead with this one. Is literally yesterday I get a text message from somebody in the industry who's preparing some information asking me, We're having a debate right now in the office about inflation pressures. And half of the office thinks that we should use the maximum inflation pressure on the sidewall of the other, on the tire. And the other half of the office thinks that we should use what it says in the inflation pressure guide, like on the door jamb or on the gas tank lid. And I mean, that's an example of tires have been around for well over 100 years, so this is not necessarily new territory here. The maximum inflation pressure on the sidewall of the tire, that's indicating if you go beyond that, you have you're risking life and limb because this thing could blow up. I mean, that's dangerous to go above that. That has nothing to do with what you should be inflating it to. Always go for what it says on the door jamb or on the gas tank lid for the factory inflation pressure.
Oh, you know what? You should tell them the story about the best door jam sticker you ever saw.
Yeah, okay, so this is my favorite inflation pressure sticker on the planet. All right? I'm a geek connoisseur when it comes to inflation pressure stickers. It happens to be on a Koenigsegg. So if you look at, for example, the new one-to-one, the Koenigsegg one-to-one, you open up the door, which in and of itself...
I'll check that when I get home.
Yeah, check it out. It's the coolest opening door in the world, first of all. But when you take a look at the door jamb, it'll have a big sticker that has three sets of pressure. So it says normal driving, high-speed driving, and track driving. And for normal driving, it's up to 217 miles an hour. Anything below 217 is just normal.
With that car, it is, though. I mean, that's the way it goes. So there's something about contact patch. It's a fallacy, because I think that's one of the things that everybody kind of focuses on is, you know, you plus size your tires, you get a different size contact patch. Everybody thinks it's bigger. It's not necessarily bigger. But that's not everything to the tire is the amount of tire that's on the road.
Well, yeah, I'll kick it to Oscar, but the one my understanding of it is this idea of I put wider tires on it and the handling's way better, and it's, or you know, you think you get more grip because it's a wider tire. It's not that simple. That you're, in general, and like I said, correct me if I'm wrong, the contact patch remains the same. What the biggest factor in if you just add width, you have like same basic diameter tire, it's the overall diameter of the tire that dictates the contact patch.
Well, it is, but it's also the orientation of the contact patch. So the taller the tire, the longer the contact patch is along the center, you know, parallel to the center axis of the car. So that if you take a look at a dragster, that's why a dragster has super tall tires, because the contact patch is a lot longer. So if the direction of that contact patch is bigger, that's the direction that it's better able to put power down. So if I want to accelerate faster, I want to be able to get more traction in a straight line, I want a much taller tire because it makes the contact patch longer. One of the benefits of a wider tire is laterally. So if I'm going around, I can go around corners faster because I have a longer contact patch perpendicular to the center line of the car, helping me giving lateral traction going around corners.
But if you, like, for instance, if you add 10 millimeters to your section width, so that, you know, the first number in the tire size, and, you know, that's not enough to really influence, because the ratio, the two-digit number, you know, you have like a 235-45. The second number is a ratio for people that don't know. So if you add 10 millimeters to that width, you're not appreciably changing the ratio so much that the diameter changes. The misconception that I hear a lot, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that adding that 10 millimeters gives you more overall contact patch when you're really more just changing the shape of the contact patch.
Yeah, you're making it wider as opposed to long. Yeah.
But not increasing
much of
the contact.
Yeah.
A lot of that is probably also due to
suck it, trolls.
The fact that people are they're replacing old tires with new tires, and that's always the contrast too. It's like, even if they're the same size, the new ones are always better performance right out of the box. So there's that impression that, like, oh, these new tires, they're larger, they're great, and that may be, but it may just be the fact that they're new and not a different size. So It sounds like tires are complicated, though.
They're extremely complicated. I'll give you one super geek factoid kind of thing. You ever heard of an Adams model of a car?
No.
No.
So Adams model is kind of like is a digitized model of a car that's used for virtual testing. So, for example, you make a numerical model of the car so that you can test it virtually, right? And you can imagine that the more complex the car, the more data points you need to define this car in this virtual space so that you can test it. If you take a look at the size of the data file that represents an entire car for you to be able to test it virtually, it's about 1/5 the size of the file needed for a tire. That means you need almost 5 times more data to describe all the potential movement of a tire than you do for the whole car. Because a car is constrained in how many different directions it can move. The tire can move in every single direction simultaneously.
Physics.
Yeah. Geeky.
So, Dan, because you're such a dork about your winter tire obsession, if you go to michelinmedia.com, shill alert, everybody, there we have a new winter tire decision tree that you can engage with to amuse yourself.
Well, actually, that's what I was going to ask, is sort of tips for how the normal consumer who's not a geek about tires should sort of, little rules of thumb to evaluate and choose tires for their vehicles. So.
Well, you just finished saying it. Michelinman.com.
Yeah. Go to it's at michelinmedia.com, actually, right?
Oh, Michelin Media. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's for the decision tree.
Oh, okay.
That's a winter tire decision tree. If you need help figuring out what tires you should buy, just go to michelinman.com, which is the company website that covers the full spectrum of Michelin tires for every condition.
Excellent. Alex, I do really want to know what it's like on the dark side.
It's really nice.
I bet.
I'm very pleased.
So to update you podcast people, Alex now represents a couple of different automotive-related brands. And I have, in the time I've known him closely in the last 3 years, I'd say he's never been happier. You look a little more slim, too.
I've never seen him happier.
It's been very good. It's been very good to me so far. It's been what, since May? 7 months? 6 months? Whatever, yeah. With the math. I don't know.
You willingly got in a pink bunny suit there, Ralph.
Yes, I did. So. I did wear a pink bunny suit, which is actually on Twitter. So
you have to add all of these photos to the podcast post.
Oh, thank God. I'm looking forward
to
that.
Yeah, we'll totally do that. I'll snag them off.
It's important that everyone see those.
Yeah. You know, that's the way it goes. Actually, I think we're all very happy for you to see you. You're finding success.
I'm sure that your listeners are really happy that we're talking about this.
I think our listeners are going to be really happy to hear you, especially if we can, you know, get you to give us one of those famous, like, look, you're wrong about something things. But this has been such a cordial conversation.
Well, we'll have to get you back.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can come back when I can be less cordial, if that's what suits you.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
Like old times.
You come back and insult me. So, all right. So we've had, from Michelin, we've had Oscar Pareda. So thank you very much for joining us on the Autoblog podcast to fill us in a little bit about tires. And that was facilitated by handler extraordinaire Alex Nunez.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Bye.
Let's do some topics, because we have one topic. So let's do our topic.
Yeah.
And that is the North American Car and Truck of the Year finalists, where I think there's probably one real good pick in each of these. There's three finalists for each category, so
no, I disagree with that. I think there are two good picks in the car segment, and I think there are three in the truck segment.
So the finalists have been pared down to, for cars, it's Chevrolet Malibu, Honda Civic, and the Mazda MX-5 Miata, and for the truck/utility of the year, it's the Honda Pilot, the Nissan Titan XD, and the Volvo XC90. So I look at that and I don't understand how any other outcome besides the Miata and the XC90 is possible.
I largely agree with you. I will say the Civic is really good. So I think that has a very strong shot to win. A lot of people that I've been talking to about this on and off the jury have strong opinions about the Malibu being something really special and like being a big advancement for the segment or something, but I frankly don't see it. And like David just recently drove the Malibu and he didn't really
I want to know why what does the jury say about the Malibu?
They were like, oh, you know, it just like represents a big advancement for the segment, and you know, it's doing things like bringing new powertrains into the category and it's advancing style and things like that. And I'm like, do you guys remember a few years ago when the Fusion happened and then the Mazda 6 happened and the Accord's really good? And like, I probably put the Malibu like in a dead, I don't know, sixth place in the segment for me.
The Malibu is the best Malibu GMs ever made, arguably.
Yeah, at least, that's, you know, that's great. That's like being the most comfortable new catheter.
Well, it is much better. I mean, they had a lot of things to fix. You know, they in the last generation, they decided to make the car smaller when everybody else was incrementally making their cars bigger. That was a mistake. They fixed it. They finally have a real hybrid model instead of mild hybrids. That's good. It's a good hybrid powertrain. It's based on the Volt powertrain. It's like, it's pretty nice. It's quiet. It does what it's supposed to do. But like, to say that it is, you know, to say that it's even at the top of its class is, you know, it's not something I would agree with. And then to say that it is the car of the year is a bigger stretch. So I think we're kind of all on the same page that the Miata is the good car there, and that the Civic, I haven't driven the new Civic yet, but it's also should have a chance at the award.
I mean, I know a lot of the people on the jury, especially that I've talked to, are very big on like, you have to look at the car in terms of its market reach and like its, you know, overall importance and things like that. But for me, what it comes down to is I can't think of a single time this year when I was driving a car and I wouldn't have rather been driving the Miata.
Well, there's to me, that. Yeah.
Like, to me, it's just the Miata is the most important car this year because it represents a real pure enthusiast car that people genuinely care about. It's damn good in terms of pretty much everything. It looks fantastic. It's great to sit in.
It's attainable. It's fuel efficient.
It's attainable. It's fuel efficient. And it's just absolutely awesome to drive.
Steve also likes it.
I like it a little bit.
Yeah, Steve's not biased, though. He doesn't bring bias to the podcast.
So, I mean, I will understand if Civic wins because that has, a greater reach in a larger segment.
Well, and I think it's actually more important than the Miata, given that I like the Miata the most out of those three, but I'm a driving enthusiast, and so that's where I go with that.
I would be stoked if the Miata won. I would understand and be happy if the Civic won. I will not be thrilled if the Malibu wins.
I'd be confused if the Malibu won.
I just have to wonder how.
It's also not attractive.
I have to wonder how you pick a Malibu over the Civic and the Miata.
Yeah. I think it was one of those things where I bet the Miata and the Civic probably got a ton of votes, and then like the third thing that got like some votes and was just the next in line happened to be the Malibu.
But what I almost wonder is the car that was on the short list that didn't make it was the new Volt. I would so rather have voted the Volt than the Malibu.
Yeah, I'd be with you on that.
But I think in terms of like mainstream attainable cars, like the Malibu has more of a chance of making a dent in the market, but it's competing
with
like... Yeah,
but that should be the criteria.
Yeah, but the Volt's a more important car.
I guess, but sort of like in terms of taking the car and its market and things like that, the problem for the Malibu is that its market is dominated by the Camry and the Accord. And even now,
and it will continue to be.
Right, exactly. Like, it's a good car. I'm sure it competes pretty fairly with those cars, and it looks great. I think its styling actually looks really
that's
good.
That's where you're wrong.
So again, I'll be wrong.
So for the truck side, though, I mean, the Volvo is my favorite.
Yeah, absolutely.
I haven't driven the Titan yet.
The 2004 Ford Super Duty?
Yeah, I like the Pilot enough, but the Volvo is really what does it for me.
Yeah, I mean, the Volvo has one of the nicest automotive interiors at any price
ever.
Right now.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful on the outside, and it drives nicely, and it's like, it's a meaningful car for Volvo, certainly. It's like, this is our first new car after all that stuff that happened, and it's a really, really great effort, and it's, you know, we all like it. And yeah, the Pilot is good.
The Pilot's going to win.
It may.
I don't think it will. I think there's a lot of people, because I know the jury, and
you know all of the jury? The whole jury? all of them?
I know them. There are a lot of people that still focus on the whole, like, it's truck of the year, and the Titan's a truck.
Well, that's just silly.
So I'm going to vote for the truck.
Titan?
Well,
were there other trucks that were eligible? Eligibility for this is a little weird because of like what rolled out last year and when the Titan arrived and all that. So what is the Titan competing with?
Nothing. There are no other trucks.
There were no other finalist trucks, right? Or maybe there were SUVs.
No, but it's in the truck/SUV category.
Right. It's officially called the truck/utility of the year. So, but there are no other pickup trucks in that category.
Right, because all of the new stuff happened last year.
Right.
Well, the Tacoma was...
I'm sorry, you're right. Tacoma was in there too.
Yeah, but the Tacoma is like... It. Yeah.
And something else? No.
I don't think
Probably
so.
Probably not.
You're right. Tacoma was there. That made it to the shortlist, but not the finalists.
So. Yeah, because the Tacoma is like window dressing on the fundamentally old truck, so...
Correct.
Yeah.
It's and still, I mean, still good
to
truck.
to some extent, the Titan is the same thing because it's based on a chassis that came out with the big NV van. So it's not. I mean, that chassis is new to the pickup, but it's not
right
as the automakers like to say, all new.
All new. They like to say all new, even when
they do, even though it's never, ever, never.
Best in class.
First in class. The first ever.
The first ever. The first and best all new ever.
We are the only ones who ever had the idea to put four rubber tires under a box and put an engine in. Yeah. So
I remember one time, this is like anecdotal, but someone at Ford once pitched me something about how something was best in class. And I'm like, what class?
Right.
They're like, oh, it's in the class of small to mid-size SUVs with front-wheel drive and turbocharged engines. And I was like, what?
That's a class of one. That's,
is it maybe the only one in that class right. that you created out of thin air?
The Escape and the Tiguan.
Yeah, yes. There's that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that the Pilot is going to be sort of the one that wins there, although I would dearly love as a Volvo enthusiast to see the Volvo win because it's beautiful and it's like a waypoint for the brand. So
I don't know, man. I think the Volvo's got a good shot. I think the fact that Motor Trend named it SUV of the Year maybe opens the door a little bit. Though Motor Trend did name the Camaro Car of the Year, which is crap, by the way.
We can talk about all of the things that Motor Trend has named the of the year since they've been doing their of the year nonsense. So,
but so I don't know. It could win. I don't think the Pilot's actually going to win. I think that there are enough people that are so hellbent on the whole truck of the year thing that they'll just vote Titan because of the body style. And I think the other half of the jury will vote for the Volvo because it's the best. And one of those two will win.
And then sometime the same day we'll announce our of the year award and everyone will forget about these awards.
Exactly.
Right.
Technology of the year is where it's at.
Right.
Excellent.
Just a little plug for Autoblog. The Autoblog podcast.
For Autoblog, I'm David Gluckman.
No, he's not. Don't listen to him.
No.
All right, let's go. Let's do Q&A now. We're just going to get mired in circular opinion discussion. So.
All right.
Let's just go. And we have some questions. The first question is, why are cars so hard to see out of, especially cars like the Camaro? And I think that's probably style.
Well, you could answer that question in a general sense and then go specifically for the Camaro. In the general sense, cars are hard to see out of because safety standards. Mm-hmm. And safety standards mean you have to put a bunch of extra metal in places where in old cars you had glass. And this is a good thing for being safe on the road, but it's a bad thing for being able to see the road and avoid the accident from which you need to be safe.
Well, and it's also because in adding all those safety features and things, automakers still want to make their cars look good, and you have to worry about things like aerodynamics. And an aerodynamic car is not a car that's easy to see out of.
Also true.
But then there's the Camaro, which I don't.
That one's a head scratcher.
That's
Camaro's supposed to be a performance car, and performance cars generally go fast, especially ones with big V8s. And then you can't see where you're going to go, so that's a missile.
Well, the Camaro is less difficult to see out of in a forward motion than it is to look back upon whence you've come, which is to say there's no way to see out the back.
Or the sides
so much.
And the mirrors are like the size of my... No, I think my... I think my phone is bigger.
Yeah, right. A lot of that is styling because they want it to look like an old Camaro, but it has to be, you know, an 1/8 scale old Camaro so that it can be big enough on the outside to still have an interior on the inside so it can have all the safety. So again, it's like, safety and a lot of other things. I remember when the first, was it the 5th-gen Camaro came out? I had to. I'm a vertically challenged American, and I had to raise my seat up very high to be able to see well out of the front and the back. And I raised it up so high that the power seat's headrest hit the headliner in the vehicle, which is something I don't think I've ever been able to do in a car. And I haven't tried to repeat that in the new Camaro yet, but it will be one of my first tests.
Okay. I mean, it just, it's a beautiful car. It's beautiful to look at from the outside.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. Come on.
It looks like a Camaro. We'll say that.
Yeah. I mean, retro, I've been tired of retro. Retro is dreadful. The original Camaro was a crap box. It was based on, you know, what, the Nova, the Chevy 2, whatever. Just terrible cars from the 60s. Like the baby boomers, you take your nostalgia and go away. I don't want to see any more Mad Men. I don't want to see vinyl. Just leave me alone and give me new stuff. That's all I have to say about that. So another question, do you think the VW scandal will do damage to the value of all diesel cars? Kind of like the Oldsmobile thing did for all diesels back in the early 80s.
Probably not. I mean, it's going to hurt, obviously, Volkswagen diesel's values, and it's going to hurt Volkswagen values for a little while in general. I don't think it's going to hurt the future of diesel and new cars, but I don't know that it's going to have a ton of effect on values of other cars, because people who want diesels still want diesels, and especially if fewer companies come out with diesels in the future, that means there's just going to be a finite supply of modern diesel vehicles in the United States. So in some ways it could sort of, in a weird way, help their values, let's say. That's my guess.
It's a very weird circular way to think about it. I mean, my guess would be that what Volkswagen was trying to do was make diesel more mainstream. And I think this sets them back to where they had been before, where it's still a niche that people want it. Certain people want it. Establishing a more mass appeal, that's probably going to be difficult. They're giving up gains from where they had been. But overall, it probably will ding sort of the consumer opinion at large. But diesel fans are going to be diesel fans.
Yep.
Damn it, you guys. Stop agreeing with me.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, Dan.
You agree with me first.
All right. One more question, and that's the Hyundai G90. Sort of, where does that fit?
How is it going to compete? Genesis G90.
Genesis G90. I'm sorry, not Hyundai. What is that going to do to that lineup? Like, it's a big car, even larger than the Equus. So they've got Genesis, Equus, Genesis Coupe, and now G90?
Right. So Genesis Coupe is going to go away for a little bit. G90 will be the Equus. The Genesis, as we know it, is going to be called G80. There's going to be a rear-drive midsize sedan that launches after that called G70. And then there will be a luxury SUV and a sport coupe, so like a Genesis coupe replacement, that will happen as well.
It's a lot
but
of
I don't
G's.
Know. I don't know when Genesis sedan officially becomes G80.
And what does that do to the lineup? Like, I guess the assumption is that the Genesis sedan sells for a pretty steep discount. Like, you know, now you're adding another thing on top that's going to also sell for short money, and it's going to be larger and, you know, supposedly more luxurious than the Genesis sedan, which is supposed to be the.
Well, it's just you'll have the Genesis sedan, and then you'll have the Equus.
Yeah, they're just getting a different name.
They're just getting different names.
And they're making a new Equus, which they kind of needed to do because the Genesis had leapfrogged the Equus a year ago.
Yeah, I actually really like the Genesis. The current Genesis is really, really good.
Uh-oh, he's not going to get any disagreement.
Nobody agrees? Agrees. Ugh. All right.
I hate it.
Look. You hate it? No, I bet you don't.
That's not true. I don't love it, but I actually have only had limited experience in the new one, so I cannot make a qualified, angry opinion out of that.
I can't argue that they addressed the issue. You know, they noticed that the original Genesis rode and handled kind of crappy, so they asked Lotus to fix it. So props for that. And I like that car a lot. So if the improvement we've seen from first gen Genesis to second gen happens with, you know, the Equus or the G90, then that's going to be a great car. It's going to be a great value. And with that, because you guys aren't going to disagree with me, that's going to make the podcast really non-entertaining. So we should just go and see everybody next week.
I disagree. Let's go.
All right. Thanks for listening. Podcast 458. David Gluckman, Stephen Ewing, thanks for taking the time. We'll catch everybody next week.
Thank you, Dan.
Bye.
You can subscribe to the Autoblog podcast in iTunes, send us an email at podcast@autoblog.com, or find us on Twitter @AutoblogPodcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.